And of course, the Carolian and Restoration period overlap then with perhaps the most ostentatious, I think most exciting and beautiful architectural period in British architectural history, which was, of course, the English Baroque period, when arguably our most famous houses were built. So that historically, English Baroque was seen as from the Great Fire of London of 1666 through to, I think, 1713, the signing of the Treaty of Utrecht, is it? Yeah, roughly 1720. But actually some of those styles carried on, because I think Vanbrugh, who was our most well-known English Baroque architect, yeah, he died in 1726. So again, there are blurred lines, but the English Baroque architecture was extraordinary. I think is especially in light of sort of our role in Europe historically, Britain being in Europe but not quite in Europe. You know, we're an island, we're not attached to Europe. We've always been slightly separate. And I think English Baroque period sort of sums that up in a sense that it's, you know, got huge European influences, but was never as ostentatious or as decadent as European Baroque. So you did see these enormous country houses, stately homes, you might say, built with a lot of dramatic contrast, which would enhance the grandeur of the buildings. So exaggerated enhancements. I'm thinking, for example, having tall buildings and tall windows contrasting with small windows, higher with narrow blocks, you know, flanking wings that would accentuate the central facade. You had a mixture of rounded and angular features, a lot of statues and urns and balustrading, columns, pediments, especially I'm thinking I think English Baroque was sort of the first period where you started to see the use of columns and pediments and the classical orders much more clearly. Towers, domes, I'm thinking, of course, a lot at the moment about Castle Howard, which had all those things. It has the columns, it has the domes, it has the you know, it's all sorts. It's almost Rococo, but it's not as flamboyant or over the top as Rococo. So I guess thinking about examples of English Baroque architects and houses, of course, there are the great English Baroque houses such as Vanbrugh's houses, you know, Blenheim and Castle Howard and so many others. Other examples, Seaton Delaval Hall, for example, in Northumberland. Other examples are Durham Park in Gloucestershire, which was built in 1704 near Bath, which is a beautiful house built by William Talman, who also did the facade of Chatsworth, perhaps our most famous country house. And Durham was built in 1704, so towards the end of the English Baroque period, or actually mid-English Baroque period. And I think our most famous architects, I think you'd agree, Connor, with the exception of Inigo Jones, who was more Restoration and Jacobean, our most famous architects, Sir Christopher Wren, John Vanbrugh, and Nicholas Hawksmoor, were English Baroque architects. And what I find extraordinary is the lasting legacy of such a short-lived period in history. Some of our most iconic buildings are English Baroque. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's interesting, Jeff, when you mentioned Rococo, because I do agree that that period of English Baroque is probably one of the closest, considering the Georgian and Victorian period, that was the closest we came to the continental direction of country houses. When people want to recognize that period, just telltale signs, when it comes to the frieze, where the cornice is, above the windows, where the transition is to the roof, you will find on the frieze, below the cornice, there will be a lot of sculpture and maybe an elaborate capital to the columns, and just ornament galore. Now, not as much as you'd see in Germany or in France, perhaps, but certainly very much in that character. And you could say that we moved away from Baroque with the Whig ascendancy. So this comes back to what's happening in the greater world, what's happening in the political world, how that affects architecture. And the Whig ascendancy led to a decline of English Baroque, which was associated with the continent. And it was seen as too Catholic, too Tory. And then, of course, the perfect example of this, which we can talk about in our next episode, is Wentworth Woodhouse, which has Baroque on the back and Palladian classical epitome of Georgian England on the front. And that was built at the time of this transition away from the Rococo, away from the ornate and Baroque. And it's a fascinating house, but it encapsulates this period perfectly.
And I believe that his main motivation for that new design was to impress the Whigs, right? That was, as you said,
yeah,
that was
the Palladian facade. You mean the Palladian facade at Wentworth Woodhouse?
Yes, yeah, that huge Palladian facade.
It was exactly right. It was to impress the Whigs after that. I mean, it is an extraordinary house because it's sort of three houses in one, isn't it? And the Baroque facade is so different to the Palladian facade. But that links well with the next period, which is, of course, Palladian. And, you know, again, there was overlap. So the Baroque period finished in 1740, but the Palladian period started in 1715. And is sort of early Georgian in its style. And Connor, you can talk more about Palladian and what its sort of ideology was. But it was based, I guess, on the idea of perfect symmetry. So rather than, although the Baroque houses like Blenheim and Castle Howard were symmetrical, they also had idiosyncrasies to them, whereas Palladianism was much more austere. They got rid of the Corinthian capitals and started using, the plainer classical orders. There were some, obviously they still use Corinthian capitals, but you saw more use of, for example, Ionic capitals, which is a bit simpler. And there's a sense of sort of, yeah, it was really in the Palladian period where they started using pediments. I mean, it's funny you say, we talk about how it was a move away from sort of Europe and the decadence of Europe, but actually, you know, Palladian architecture is the most pure Roman or Greek architecture there is. But I guess in those days, Italy and Greece didn't hold the power in the same way as Germany or France. So maybe it was more acceptable to be associated with ancient Roman and ancient Greek architecture than it was to be associated with German or French Rococo styles. Connor, maybe talk a bit more about Palladianism and sort of what its key features were and what its key point was, I guess.
Yes, well, Palladianism comes from the name, the man, Andrea Palladio, and he was an architect in the Veneto, the Venice province of northern Italy. And that's where he practiced. He designed country houses. And what makes a Palladian house is essentially a central block with wings, ancillary service wings. And they are connected to the house, usually by a colonnade. And the principal rooms, the piano nobile, the noble floor, is above ground level. And it's reached by a flight of steps. And that's where you'll find the drawing room, the great hall, and this tradition that was adopted entirely in England and continues to be, I must say, with country houses, this format. Bedrooms above, kitchens below, and then wings extending out into sometimes a kitchen wing, or it might be a ballroom, and then on the other side you have stables. But all connected to the house. They weren't separate buildings as previously done, just around the house. And it was certainly more restrained. As it was moving away from Baroque and Rococo in search for a more austere, less ornate style, this Palladio's architecture became influential, and it lended itself very well to this new approach.
I guess we can't talk about Palladian architecture without mentioning Lord Burlington, who really brought Palladian architecture in its full glory to England. Lord Burlington was, I guess, one of the early Renaissance men, wasn't he? In the sense not of liking Renaissance architecture, but in the sense of being a polymath, having so many different interests. And he, of course, famously built Burlington House. Chiswick House is a great example of one of his houses, which was almost entirely based on a Palladian house by Andrea Palladio, wasn't it? It was based on the Villa Rotunda in Italy?
It was, yeah, the Villa Rotunda.
With its central block, and then on each side it has a protruding pediments and columns, and it's almost like a Roman temple.
A dome on top and a drop.
A dome on top, exactly right. And I guess other examples of Palladian architecture, I mean, when you watch a Jane Austen film, you think of the classic, you know, in Emma or in, you know, Pride and Prejudice, you think of the classic great country houses like, you know, the old BBC adaptation of Pride and Prejudice, which was filmed at what's that house in near Manchester called? That extraordinary house. Lyme Park. Lyme Park is a great example of Palladian architecture. Enormous, with its enormous protruding pediment and columns, and other slightly smaller examples, but perfect in their symmetry, are Stourhead or Prior Park in Somerset. And of course, the greatest Palladian house, I guess, in England, arguably, that still stands and is still owned by the family who built it, is Holkham Hall in Norfolk, which was built in, which was finished in 1764. Sorry, yeah, 1764, which is an extraordinary house because of its the contrast, I think, with Holkham is so interesting because of the austere classical simplicity of its external facades, which contrasts with its very rich, decadent interiors. You know, all the silks and the silk walls, and you know the statuary and the marbles that are used and all that. I mean, it contrasts hugely with the very plain stone facades of Holkham. And I think that's what makes Palladian architecture so lovely in some ways, is it sort of, it surprises you when you see such an austere outside and then you go in and there's all this beauty inside. Whereas sometimes I find with a house like Castle Howard or Blenheim, it's a bit of a disappointment when you get inside because the outside is so beautiful. Certainly I find this with Castle Howard, the outside is so beautiful. You're sort of wowed as you go up the drive, you know, through the park, the Castle Howard Park. And then you get into the house and it's sort of the same, but it's, you know, Holkham, the contrast makes the interior so much more special. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I agree. I think with this simplicity to a Palladian house, they lend themselves incredibly well to the changes in landscape design at the time in country estates. Of course, Capability Brown and the Brownian landscape, that naturalistic the look of a forest which had been partially felled, so it was untilled landscape, a parkland setting, and this simple house within that sort of natural house, natural landscape, as opposed to a Baroque house and a Brownian landscape, they don't fit as comfortably together.
Mm.
The earlier houses, of course, had parterre gardens and an army of gardeners associated around the house. But of course, with the turn of the century into the Georgian period, 18th century, we had the natural landscapes and the Palladian house. And just for our audience, the telltale sign of a Palladian house is a central block. So the main house in the middle, and it's larger than the smaller subsidiary buildings either side. And most often than not, they are connected. But when you see that, you're looking at a Palladian house.
What are your thoughts, Ben?
Well, they look beautiful, is my thought. And I wasn't too clued up on Palladian houses. I've been to many of them, but as you say, I'm less knowledgeable on these styles. So I found this conversation fascinating. Especially how beforehand it seemed like the cathedral and the house were sort of linked in their architecture because of the style. Whereas was that changed because less cathedrals were being built? Was it, you know, what am I trying to articulate here?
I see what you mean. I think that's absolutely true. I think after the Reformation, we saw a lot of the English Reformation, we saw a lot of cathedrals destroyed and very few rebuilt. And so what you ended up getting is a sort of cathedrals were trapped in the sort of Romanesque and Gothic periods. Whereas the church lost its wealth in a way that it didn't have the wealth or power. It didn't wield the same power or wealth that it had before. So you found that wealth was instead concentrated more in landowners. And so that's why we saw the evolution of the country house, but not the evolution of ecclesiastical buildings in the same way, except of course when you have parish churches built by landowners, and then you would often see in the grounds of a Georgian country house, yes, you might have a Norman church or a little Gothic church, but equally you might see a Regency church or a Georgian church built in the grounds. Or especially as London began to grow, you saw a lot of Georgian churches were popping up around London. I guess it's interesting that we think about cathedrals. You know, St. Paul's, which is one of our greatest cathedrals, you know, arguably with Westminster Abbey, which isn't really a cathedral, it's a royal peculiar, but it's essentially a cathedral, there aren't any other cathedrals like St. Paul's. You know, St. Paul's was only built because the previous St. Paul's, the Gothic St. Paul's, burnt down in the Great Fire of London. Mm-hmm. That they built the classical one, but I guess there wasn't the same money or investment in building enormous church buildings. Again, it was partly because maybe the kingdom had changed and power was more centralized in London. You saw less need for, you know, the power wasn't in the regional cities. So they had their cathedral in York or in Exeter or in Lincoln or in Durham, but as the power became more centralized away from London, towards London, away from those regional cities, so there was less invested interest in changing ecclesiastical architecture like there was for landowners building country houses. And I guess it's interesting thinking about Palladian and Baroque and Georgian. The Georgian period, actually, you know, people used Georgian architecture as a very loose term, but it also was an architectural style. Because what's interesting, just looking at the different periods, the Georgian period ran from 1714 to 1830. Those were the years of the King George's. So when you refer to a Georgian building, it could be anything between 1714 and 1830. Yeah, what's interesting is within that period, you get English Baroque, or the latter half of English Baroque, and then you get Palladian. So Palladian is entirely Georgian, because Palladianism was essentially most common in England between 1715 and 1780, which falls totally within the wider Georgian period of 1714 to 1830. So all Palladian houses essentially are Georgian, but the Georgian period was broader. So the Georgian period, you know, developed later into Regency, and the Georgian period embodied a lot of that restraint, the Palladian restraint, rather than the Inigo Jones inspired sort of Baroque and Restoration and Renaissance architecture. But what was interesting was the development of the country house. So in the Georgian period, so we started seeing a lot more. The symmetry continued, the harmony of the sort of external facades and sash windows became commonplace. So the larger rectangular panes set in wooden glazing bars became common, and it made it much easier to make bigger windows. Doorways started being placed centrally, with rooms spreading away. And what's interesting, I'm just reading here, a reliable way to tell the difference between Georgian houses and early Inigo Jones houses is to look at the size. So although Inigo Jones or Restoration or Renaissance houses can be quite stately, the Georgian style became popular for smaller houses as well. So what's interesting is you rarely see an English Baroque townhouse. There are a few examples, but really they were used on a huge scale, whereas the Georgian style, because it was so simple in its classicism, it could be translated into houses of any size. So yes, you get the great houses like Holkham or Stourhead or Prior Park, but you also get smaller houses, rectories. You get actually almost tiny little Georgian cottages, as well as, of course, the famous Georgian townhouses that London and Bath, yes, and Bath, yeah, are so famous for. So it became a much more innovative and transferable style, because it could be used on a huge scale or a much smaller scale. And I think that's why the Georgian styles, I think that's partly why the Georgian style, and Connor, you as a neoclassical architect can probably testify this, why the Georgian style is so timeless, is because it's so transferable. You can have any size house in the Georgian style. And of course, it's timelessly beautiful because of its classical simplicity. Is that fair, Connor?
Yes, it's classical simplicity and the proportions. They lend themselves well to longevity, and they don't have the telltale signs of a Baroque house, say, that immediately dates it of a certain period. So there's not a whole lot going on the facade, but what is happening is beautifully crafted. So there's a crisp cornice. there might be an architrave around the window, but it's all quite simple, classical elements. I would add that during that period of the restrained Palladian classical, there was also Gothic, and there was Batty Langley, the architect, who designed Follies, and Payne's Hill. There's a folly in the estate, which is Gothic. Now, this is Gothic with a K as opposed to ending with a C. And this would have been 18th century. The most notable Gothic with a K would be, Strawberry Hill, which would be called Strawberry Hill Gothic. And that was designed by author Horace Walpole between 1749 and 1776. And if the audience look at Strawberry Hill, it is very much in the tradition of the Georgians. It's the same approach they've had to the classical tradition, where it is restrained, but it has a lot of the elements that people associate with that style, with Gothic. It has the pointed windows, it has the trefoil, the rose window, finials, buttresses, and of course on the inside, just like the Palladian houses, far more elaboration, far more ornament and craftsmanship, but simple exteriors.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. You talk about Regency Gothic as in Gothic with a K, Strawberry Hill Gothic, and that actually ties in perfectly with the next period, of course, which we saw after, of arguably the last period of the great English country houses, was Victorian Gothic, which isn't Gothic with a K, but came after Regency Gothic. And towards the end of the Regency period, you began to see, like you said, the houses like Strawberry Hill. Then you have Gothic Revival. So Gothic Revival, or Victorian Gothic, as we think about it, was sort of from the late 18th century through to the end of the 19th century. And that's when we think about, it very much brought back. It was, it's funny. It's funny how it's sort of, everything comes full circle. The great Gothic buildings of old were sort of copied, and you look at, obviously we think of great examples, Pugin and Barry, and the House of Parliament is a great example of, or the Palace of Westminster is a great example of Gothic revival. But I guess the Victorian Gothic, there were elements of Tudor revival in that period as well, and the Gothic revival period is almost castle-like in its features. It harks back to pre-Tudor times. So you've got battlements, you've got roof decoration, towers, arches, pointed windows again, sometimes even arrow slits just for decoration. And I guess examples of Gothic revival are things like, the Highclere Castle, where that's more Jack. Would you say Highclere is Jacobean, or would you say there's so much overlap. It was essentially... Yeah. The Victorian period was a period of revival in previous architectural styles, wasn't it? So you get the Palace of Westminster as a great example of Gothic revival, but you also get, revivals of Elizabethan and Jacobean period style architecture as well, but on a grander scale.
Yes, a Jacobean, absolutely, for Highclere Castle, and the whether it's the turret-like structures that make up the corners, the fact that in between each window there is a pilaster, but not a classical pilaster. There's strap work, there's finials. So it's now Highclere was, of course, a classical house. It was a Georgian, maybe not Palladian house, but it was a simple classical house that became Jacobean when Charles Barry was commissioned by the family.
Actually, John, it's probably worth saying in Ireland there are some great examples of some really extraordinary Gothic revival houses. I can think of a few examples in England, like Shadwell Court in Norfolk, like I mentioned, or Stanley Park in Gloucestershire, which essentially look like Gothic castles. But I guess some examples, the Guinness has invested hugely in building new houses in Ireland. And what's that one that's now a hotel that's an extraordinary Gothic castle?
Now a hotel, there's Adair.
Adair, maybe it's Adair. I'm not thinking
also, of it. Also, Lugala is quite similar. Lugala in Wicklow is quite similar to Strawberry Hill Gothic. And Loch Cutra, where the king, then Prince of Wales, stayed in Galway, is fortress-like. It's like a castle. And also Dromoland Castle, which the roof was removed to avoid paying the tax, because of course the tax was on whatever, wherever the roof covers, so they just took the roof off and it became a ruin in the 40s, I think. But
I'm thinking of Ashford Castle.
Ashford. An
extraordinary castle. I think it's in County Mayo. It's on the Galway border, isn't it?
That's right, in Cong. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. But it's an extraordinary
hunting lodge and grew. So looking at that house, you can see the organic growth just into a vast castle.
Yeah, but that was largely built in the Victorian period.
It was
very much in the Gothic Revival style.
It's important to remember that in the Victorian period, with the advent of new money, that building castles was a way of rooting a family further back than they may actually be come from. Now, that could be an existing family or a new family through industry or building a house. So it was, I think it was Wentworth House, not Wentworth Woodhouse, but Wentworth Castle, in fact, where, now this is the 18th century, so it doesn't really fit into the Victorian, but this similar things happened where a castle was built as a ruin on the estate so that guests on arrival would see the ruin, and it would suggest that the owners had been on that estate going back to 1066, say. So it rooted them far earlier by using architecture.
Mm. That's really interesting. I think I'm just thinking, it's funny how we had such, you know, the peak of the English country house in many ways was the Victorian period, the Georgian period as well, but the Victorian period, when there was a lot of money from the empire coming in, a lot of Britain was the most powerful country in the world, and that was seen in the building of these extraordinary country houses. And you know, we will talk in another episode, like you said, about the decline of the English country house in the 20th century, but it leads on nicely to probably, I would say, the last distinct country house period that we had in England, because after the First World War, there was a short period when some Art Deco houses were built, and then we had the Second World War, and after the Second World War, we've never really had a distinct architectural period for country houses. We've had individual country houses that have been built in traditional styles. I'm thinking of Fern Park in Dorset as a classical example, or a Palladian example. We've had some extraordinary modern and modernist country houses, but they're generally sort of one-offs rather than a distinct style. The last distinct style I would say we had in English country house architecture was the arts and crafts period. I don't know if you agree, Connor, the arts and crafts period was sort of the latter half of the Victorian period merging into Edwardian, so sort of 1860 through to 1914. Would you say arts and crafts was the last sort of distinct style of country house that was built on a mass scale?
I would agree, but and I also add to that and say that it's not until time has passed and you're looking back at a particular decade or so that you can put your finger on the style of that time. And I do think that if you look at, say, Quinlan Terry to now, and the majority of country houses which are built, it tends to be, you could say, Palladian inspired, but Palladian, and of course, you're thinking of that they are lacking the portico and the basement, the wings. It, generally speaking, it's just the main block, and it's a red brick country house with stone dressings. So there is a modernized or a neo-Palladian, perhaps you might call it, where you have a stone cornice, probably Tuscan or Doric. And if there are columns, it's just either side of the door, a set of columns and a simple porch, rather than a projecting portico. So it's a restrained version of where we were in the, I suppose, 1720s, 1730s, with that early Palladian red brick Flemish bond country house. And looking at predominantly what is built over the last 20 years in country houses, I think a lot of them would fall under that broad description.
That's really helpful. And that's probably a good place to sort of end. I mean, it would be nice to talk a little bit about arts and crafts, but actually I think what you've done is you've summed up. So I guess I can, in a nutshell, say, so arts and crafts was sort of a slightly modern twist on traditional architecture, as was Gothic Revival. But again, arts and crafts sort of marked the end of the great country house, because arts and crafts houses were built on a smaller scale. You didn't see the great stately homes built in arts and crafts. You know, I think of, you know, Lutyens collaborating with Jekyll and doing houses like Munstead Wood and Goddard's in Surrey, Vowood and Norfolk, and Overstrand Hall in Norfolk as well. That's specifically those two counties are common for their arts and crafts style. But it's not, it's funny how, you know, sort of the decline of Britain, and we've seen that manifest in its country houses. And yet it's wonderful, like you say, Connor, that, you know, this sort of modern twist on traditional architectural styles that we've seen in the last sort of 50 years might well in time prove to be that period's sort of style. So like you said, with Quinn and Terry, and I'm also thinking with companies like, you know, other architectural companies which may be more diverse, you know, Quinlan and Francis are well known for doing their classical houses, but, you know, other architectural practices like Adam Architecture, amongst others, do a mix of arts and crafts and classical. And again, there's a, you know, I think of the likes of who's your colleague, Connor, who's done quite a lot of arts and crafts houses?
Hugh Petter.
Hugh, yeah, exactly, Hugh. He, you know, again, if you look at a Hugh Petter arts and crafts house that's been built in the last 20 years, again, it's not
Nigel Anderson as well.
Am I? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. They're not exact copies of what Lutyens was doing in the early 20th century. They're sort of a modern take on arts and crafts style, like you said, Quinlan and Francis have done with their classical style. And it will be interesting to see in time. But we very much, I think, it's probably fair to say that even though we are seeing some beautiful country houses built, even up to the present day, we're not seeing anything on the scale of those past periods. We're not seeing castles, but I think the last castle to be built in England was by Lutyens, and it was Castle Drogo in Devon.
There was that castle built for the Barclay brothers.
Yes, that was Quinlan and Terry. He did that in Sark, but that's technically not. Is Sark part of Britain? Sort of.
No, well.
But yes, it was an extraordinary castle, and that was a proper.
Yes. Yeah. Would you agree, Jeff, that just on that last period of the arts and crafts, thinking of Goddard's, Lutyens' work, really, the country houses, Marsh Court, for example, in Hampshire, that they departed from perhaps what a country house historically was ever built for as the hub of circle, the head of a landed estate, that these Lutyens houses, this particular period of the early 20th century, they were party houses, they were entertainment houses, as opposed to running an estate house. It was a different mechanism. They were designed and used for partying. The estate no longer provided income through agriculture to support great houses by this period. And that was, the writing was on the wall in the 1870s, 1880s, and then by the First World War, of course. But thinking of Goddard's, Marsh Court, these are country houses, but departed from the function that we would attribute to earlier houses.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair, Connor. And I think it also links a lot with the role of the British court and the British monarch, again, you know, linking back to the idea of country houses reflecting what's going on in the wider sort of kingdom or United Kingdom. Is, of course, we think about the great houses of old, they were often built to impress the monarch and built to host the monarch. You know, there are dozens of country houses where they built new wings in anticipation for when the monarch would visit, right up to the Victorian period. You know, there were houses that had royal bedchambers put in for if Queen Victoria visited. Whereas I suppose with the decline of the British Empire and I guess the diminishing role of the monarch, for good or for ill, the diminishing role of the monarch in society, we've seen the monarch doesn't do these grand tours of Britain, staying at her friends' country houses or her courtiers' country houses anymore, that they would have done in previous generations. And I think that's part of, like you say, it's, you know, country houses, you know, they no longer have the staff. You know, not only can they not afford the staff, but they probably can't get the staff these days to use these houses. So the role of entertaining the monarch, the role of impressing the monarch, the role of entertaining other great county families has diminished hugely. And I think you're right, the arts and crafts movement reflected that, even though the arts and crafts movement was obviously at the height of the British Empire, you know, right up to 1914 was really when the arts and crafts movement finished. It's funny that you rarely found a great entertaining house in the arts and crafts style. But it is encouraging, Connor, that there are good architects out there today who are seeking to take the best of those periods we talked about from the last 1,000 years, take the best of all those architectural periods and marry them with modern, you know, living expectations, you know, of having the kitchen now. You know, I think it's interesting, you know, the kitchen is now, even in the greatest houses in England, you know, there's now a family kitchen, whereas there never would have been 200 years ago, you know. And I think about the number of houses, you know, friends of mine who are interior designers who have done houses where, you know, they want to move the kitchen. You know, I think of that wonderful house in Oxford, a Farringdon house, where there was this exquisite drawing room that, you know, for years, I think it was Lord Berners who lived there, and he had this exquisite drawing room. And, you know, the last owner who moved in tore out all the, you know, the Georgian, you know, tore out the Georgian fire surround and put an arger in and, you know, turned that drawing room into a kitchen because it has to be more flexible for modern living. And, you know, it's lovely that new architects building new houses like yourself and your colleagues are trying to marry practicality with beauty from all those past periods.
I think what's wonderful is that compared to the continent, what's echoed in the pages of Country Life, that to this day, the pinnacle of success, having made millions in London, say, the pinnacle is to establish a country estate of some sort, even if it's just a small parcel of land. It's to put a house on it and be a country gent. I think the country house market will change as it has done throughout history, but I don't think it's going away anytime soon. It's in popular culture. The popularity of the likes of Downton Abbey is proof of that. But also in terms of entertaining, country houses are still very much desirable locations for hosting wedding gatherings, celebrity parties, even business trips where they'll rent out a country house for a weekend. Shooting parties. So the culture around a country house and its purpose is, in a way, it's been rented out nowadays. It's gone to the market, so to speak. Now, that's not, thankfully, all houses. There are still many houses with that connection to the land and the people there. And many of these houses that I'm describing that are rented out, the old families still live on the grounds or in a wing, and they rent out a lot of the house, which helps pay. These houses need an income. They have exorbitant running costs. So, of course, this all contributes to repairing the roof, putting in new wiring and plumbing, which are necessary practicalities. So country houses are changing. And just as you're saying, the kitchen is at the heart of a home nowadays. In some of the grander houses that are designed, you will have a front of house kitchen. And this is where, because people like to gather in the kitchen, this is where they'll sit on the island and entertain. But the cooking for dinner happens at a back of house kitchen. So there's two kitchens. The kitchen has become a drawing room in a way.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a wonderful way to close off this, what's been a wonderful episode. And I've learned an incredible amount, and I've had the privilege of sitting back with my hands behind my head and taking this all in, hearing Jeff and Connor. And I hope people as well enjoy it as much as I have. And we'll close off with a final thought here, taking us to the present day and perhaps what is the finest upcoming landmark of the new wave of Carolean architecture with our new monarch. And I want to get your thoughts on this, and it's just brief reactions of Wayne Rooney's new Morrison's Mansion, named Morrison's because everyone thinks it looks like a Morrison's supermarket.
Oh, wow. Well, maybe then we can leave it actually on a slightly better note. So maybe you can show us that picture hanging behind your left shoulder that Connor designed as a new example.
As a better fitting.
A new Carolean architecture. As a better example of what Carolean architecture in the 21st century could look like.
This one certainly doesn't look like a supermarket.
Yes, we need to send that to Wayne Rooney, I think. And
yeah, excellent. Thanks.
And with that, Ben. Thank you both, and until next time, goodbye.